Welcome, welcome everyone to the Old In and Out. This is Dr. William Schimmel speaking, Bill Schimmel. How are you, all of you out there? And how are you, Brian Dewan, my co-host?
I am well, and I am out there too.
Yes, let's see, how out there are you? I know I'm talking to you from a different place tonight.
That's right. Well, I'm about 20 minutes away from my home in Casco. I'm in Acre, New York, at the Wave Farm Study Center.
And you're there studying.
Yeah, you might say.
So, do you have a lot of friends?
This is a place where sometimes people come to have residencies in. This is a sort of center for what they refer to as transmission arts, which really just has anything to do with transmitting signal, a very kind of open-ended approach to the endeavor of radio and broadcasting, transmitting.
Well, that's amazing. I understand you have a few, I understand you have a few of your friends with you there as well. Is that right?
Yeah, there's a bunch of people here. We're eating dinner and enjoying some wine and listening to the radio WGXC, the community radio. So it's been very kind of festive in here.
You're doing all that while you're also doing another radio show with me. Is that right?
That's correct.
So all this is going on at one time.
It's all going on at one time.
And you're eating at the same time.
We finished eating, and now I'm drinking.
Now you're drinking. What are you drinking?
I'm drinking apple cider with a little bit of whiskey in it.
Apple cider with a little bit of whiskey.
It's really autumn here now.
Yeah.
And it's getting colorful.
And so the leaves are turning, and...
The leaves are turning. Last year it took until into November for them to turn.
Yeah.
This year, it's getting colorful.
Yeah.
And the air is nice.
Is there any covered bridges around your area?
You know, there aren't around here. A little further out there are some, but here all the bridges are uncovered.
Uh-huh.
We have open-faced sandwich bridges.
Open-faced sandwich bridges. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it sounds like a good time is being had by all right now. It really does. And so let's have a good time on the air. Let's see what happens tonight. I know we had a great conversation the other day, and you dropped a subject on me, which is kind of interesting, and probably not realizing I had some connection to it. All of a sudden, we got into this conversation about mummers.
That's right. We were talking about the mummers, and I was remembering seeing the very tail end of a mummers parade in Philadelphia on New Year's Day, and a very big, burly guy in the over-the-top costume with the feathers giving directions to a guy in the station wagon and saying, "Back it up, back it up."
Well, you know something. I sort of have a little bit of I never was a full-fledged mummer. But my uncles were mummers. And are you still there, Brian? I did something.
Oh yeah.
I hear you loud and clear. Yeah. You know, my uncles were full-fledged mummers, and they were both in a particular string band. That's what they were called. The mummers units were called string bands, and they were both in the Juilliard of string bands, which was the Furco, Joseph A. Furco Band. And I used to be able to watch the New Year's Day parade from indoors. My accordion school was down in the Center City area, New Power Conservatory, and I was able to go up on the 7th floor and watch the parade, you know, where it was nice and warm and toasty, from the windows. And I used to enjoy that, and I would also beat the crowds that way also. So a bunch of us students from New Power Conservatory would go down to the school, and we'd get the key, unlock the door up on the 7th floor, and we'd watch the parade from there. You could hear everything loud and clear. It was kind of wonderful. And the Furco Band apparently won They always won in the top five category. They won more first places than anybody, but they always always won in the top five. Always. And so that's my background in it. So I had that sort of connection. My uncles were accordion players. And so Joseph Furco, the head of the string band, who was marching for many, 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 many years, lived in my neighborhood. And he had a drugstore called the Furco Pharmacy. And he was noted for making a particular kind of foot powder called Furco foot powder, which the Philadelphia Eagles use, like the football team.
Right.
And so it became, he became rather notorious with this particular foot powder. And his drugstore was in our neighborhood. It was called Furco Pharmacy. And so what would happen is every year, before he would go down to the New Year's Day parade, he would do a dry run in the St. Veronica's Catholic Schoolyard, which was only a couple blocks from my house. He would give a dry run for anybody in the neighborhood who would want to come down see it, and for the nuns at the convent there. And then he would present a bouquet of flowers to the nuns. And so that would be his dry run. Then he would head down the 2nd Street where the parade started. That was downtown in Center City. And in Mummer's language, they called it 2 Street. Like 1 Street, 2 Street. And,
that's
and,
right. It's
yeah,
close
yeah.
to 1st and 2nd.
Yeah, yeah. It was called,
one,
you know, in Mummer's
two,
language.
Street.
Yeah, it was called
two
1 Street or 2 Street. And then what they would do from then on is they would have a Mummer's Mass. And then the priest delivered a sermon, you're all winners in the eyes of God and all that kind of stuff, whether you win or lose, the sermon.
Right.
And then they would go out and then they would do their march down Broad Street. And eventually, I think my uncles, for whatever reason, they left the string bands. And one of my uncles still had an obsession for them, and he would, follow them along, running down the streets, as they were marching, and he would still follow them from the street. He still had this obsession. I don't know why he did that, by the way. I never asked.
He couldn't stop.
It was set in motion. Yeah, it was set in motion. He couldn't stop.
Even if he wasn't playing with the band, he was still moving with the parade. He was still in the current.
In the current. You're right about that. He was still in the current of that. And it's kind of, he did the same thing with the Mummer. He did also did the same thing with Frank Yankovic. Wherever Frank Yankovic went, he would appear. And as sort of a Frank Yankovic groupie. And if Frank, Yankovic came to Philadelphia, he would put Frank up at his house. And ironically, he was a pretty good accordion player. And frankly, I think I always thought he played better than Frank Yankovic. But obviously, he didn't pursue it. He didn't go out on the road. He had a local band that played, local weekends. But nonetheless, he still had an obsession with Yankovic. He still had an obsession with the Mummers. Much further after he stopped marching in the parade. I guess once it gets in your blood, and they all say that, once it gets in your blood, it doesn't leave.
Well, it seems like it's got to be that way.
Yeah.
I remember the first time I ever was aware at all of that tradition of the marching string band.
Yeah.
And if you haven't seen this, you don't really have a picture of it. I remember buying an LP, must have been pressed up in the 60s or 70s, of one of these bands, and I saw this photograph of all these men in these really over-the-top, amazing costumes with all the plumage sticking out.
Yeah.
Everyone really decked out in these otherworldly
yeah.
get-ups. And then all these people marching with cellos. And then the cellos are attached with
some
sort of harness so that your hands are free to play. And then the cello, rather than sitting against the floor with a spike, is just hovering at this angle above the ground while you can play the cello while walking down the street. And there's a bunch of them, and all of these get-ups. And I remember just being so intrigued. I bought the record.
Yeah.
And that was my introduction to this tradition.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly beats, I mean, Woody Allen should have seen that, you know, and Take the Money and Run when he was a little kid trying to play cello in a marching band, you know, with a seat. Little did he know you could actually attach the cello to yourself, you know, in March.
Right, people do it every year, and they do it in midwinter.
They do it in midwinter, and what my uncles used to do, they used to put woolen gloves on their hands with the tips cut off. So
right.
They play their accordions. Yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely a hardy men's sport.
Yeah, and needless to say, it was very, very, very competitive. And some of the top bands, I mean, it was sort of a little bit of a hierarchy. Like Furco was sort of like the Juilliard of string bands. And then there was some of my buddies who I went to high school with were also in sort of the some of the lower echelon bands, sort of some more of the lowlife bands. And who were they? Some at the bottom of the heap. There was like Furco at the top of the heap, Polish American at the top of the heap. Frelinger was always good, like in the top three category. This is what I remember. And then down in the lower echelon, there were groups like, and some of my high school buddies were in, one in particular, the Duffy String Band, the John B. Duffy String Band. And that was like, that was pretty much, they always placed next to the last. And there was a certain pride in that also. They were almost like proud that they were, you know, that they were down at the bottom for some reason or another. And I couldn't figure that out. I even went to a rehearsal one evening. And I just remember this conductor up there, he would say to a guy with a snare drum around his neck and a stogie in his mouth, and his name was Will, and the conductor would say, "Hit it, Will," and he would play the street beat. Like street beat, and they would all come in, and they did sound pretty god-awful. And then he would conduct with great pride, and then he would say, "We have a gig next Sunday, and they want the Duffy Band, not the Furco Band." And there would be a big cheer. And so forth, and there was a certain pride in that also. And,
well, I also love that there is such a thing as like the low life marching string band.
Yes.
Like, and to think of like if you are a low life character that you desire to be in a marching string band, that's the low life string band.
Well, there's always that desire that the band low in the totem pole would someday all of a sudden by some strange thing end up in one of the top ones. And that occasionally would happen. And it happened with one particular band, the Ukrainian American String Band. They were always down at the bottom. And they were always a rough sounding band. They really were. And they seemed like a very tough group of guys also. You know, you wouldn't want to mess with. You know? And they would like place like out of 16, they would place, you know, maybe sometimes 16th. You know, and one year, they sort of did something. I don't know. It just happened. They changed. Their theme was the anointment of King Solomon, and they came out and they did things that reminded one of like Ukrainian folk dances and, you know, and Ukrainian music, and of course they did that rather well, or at least rather lively. And what happened is, it actually caught on with the judges, and that year they came in like second place. Like from like 16th to 2nd. And then they realized they had a hook. And then they kind of returned to their roots, the Ukrainian roots, and they sort of kept in that theme. And they were winning in higher categories after that. That was one of those, you know, and so there was always that desire. Like if you were down there, maybe at one particular point, if you finally got that hook or that moment, you could take on like the Furco Band and so forth. There was always that hidden thing in some of the lower scored mummers bands.
Well, it's interesting too that besides, of course, the whole amazing spectacle of the music and the parading and the costumes, There's also, you're talking about the intense competitiveness of it. And also, especially in a thing where, you know, it's not like you have a foot race and you know who won. Like,
yeah.
You have these judges and there's this sort of arbitrariness and this caprice or categories. Like, it sounds really fascinating how elaborate and institutionalized all the, like, the categories are and all these different machinations to create the hierarchy, and yet it's just based on, like, what some judges or people who get into the position like.
And, you know, it could be, I think you could be judged on a lot of things. You could be judged on music. You could be judged on your marching. You could be judged on your theme, and you could be judged on your costume. I mean, all these points went in. In other words, it was all tabulated.
Right.
And it still is to this very, very, very day. And then, obviously, they would sometimes a member of the band or members of the band would do the arrangements, and sometimes the arrangements would be done on the outside. As a matter of fact, my own mentor, Dr. Neupower, did some arrangements for string bands. And as a matter of fact, my uncle, who was in the Ferko band, used to pick up the arrangements from Dr. Neupower and deliver them to the string band. That was sort of a routine. He was very young then, and he would deliver the arrangements either around the time he joined or even before he joined. And so, you know, my own mentor did some arrangements for I believe it was for Ferko. They shot high in terms of getting good sounding arrangements and tight routines and so forth.
Yeah, well, it's a fascinating world to hear about because of the kind of dedication that goes into it, and also how for something that is, you know, recreational and outside of the professional realm, you know, that people take it so seriously and get really into it, and it's almost like the intensity of a conservatory, but it's not a conservatory, it's not a music institution, it's this, you know, really a homegrown institution, and yet it becomes so elaborate and codified. And,
the head of the Duffy band once, when I went to the rehearsal, because one of my buddies in the band was studying at our conservatory, Neupower Conservatory, and he went over to the musical director and introduced me and so forth, and then said that, you know, that I and he was studying at the Neupower Conservatory. And the musical director of the Duffy band said, "Conservatories, conservatories, conservatories, you get your start in a string band. That's where you get your start." He said, you know, forget about the conservatories. It's the string band where you get your start. So they regarded it as a kind of a training ground, as a kind of a conservatory, as you said. Absolutely.
And it was kind of at home. It begins at home. And yet within that home, like, there is all this dedication and discipline.
Yeah, it comes right out of the community.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, Joe Ferko, in 1963, was honored by the String Band Association. They gave a big bash for him and a big parade for him. As a matter of fact, in the parade passed my house in North Philadelphia. We all went outside of our house to watch the bands go down, literally go down the street. And he led the parade in a car, and he waved everybody from the front. It was a convertible. And they had signs, Mr. String Band. And right before that, he actually went on the I've Got a Secret show starring Gary Moore, where they had to guess his secret. And his secret was he was marching for 50 years. 50 years in the Mummers Parade. And it was quite
amazing.
Then the band came on, and they played. And they did all Lang Syne on I've Got a Secret. It was quite touching. And
yeah, I'll bet.
So, yeah, it really was. And then you can see it on YouTube, as a matter of fact. And then what happened is they had the big parade for him. And here's where all the String Band members stopped being very, very competitive. They honored Joseph A. Ferko. And what happened is the parade passed our house, and the parade ended at a local Knights of Columbus Hall where he was going to get his plaque and a dinner. And so they called him up, and they gave him his plaque, I guess either before or after the dinner, and he made an announcement saying, "I've been marching for 50 years. I look forward to marching another 50 years. And immediately after that, say, he keeled over and he passed away right there.
Yeah, but he was ready.
He was ready.
He was ready for another 50.
He was ready for another 50 somewhere else, and that's where he'd be marching up in heaven.
Yeah, yeah. That's admirable.
And so that was it's a touching story, actually. It really is.
Yeah.
Yeah. And one of the things that I remember most was they were one of the first bands to, like, you know, break the rules and march without feathers. Which actually shocked a lot of people in the band. It shocked a lot of people.
Well, I'm shocked.
Yeah, and in 1963, they did something really unusual, and it was like performance art or conceptual art. It had a very Zen quality to the whole thing, where they were dressed up like Bowery bums, and they basically formed a circle and they played marbles and shot crap, you know, and the band played stuff like My Buddy. And, you know, Boys of the Bowery and all that kind of stuff. And it seemed
right.
They did that and marched off. It was that's what it seemed like. And they just, when it was all over, they sort of marched off. That was it. And it was, you know, you said to yourself, what just happened? And it was kind of brilliant. It was very, very, very well done. And it didn't seem like they did much more than that. And they kind of knew that they had something really new brewing. And what happened is, they, as they say in their memoir, they finished a disappointing fifth place. They still were in the top five, but they placed fifth. And they were disappointed in that. But they recreated it in 1984, and they won first place. So it was ahead of its time. Yeah.
That's such a funny thing about all these awards and things. Like, I was looking at videos on YouTube of female beatboxers, and sometimes they'd be competing in these beatbox competitions all over the world, and there's one in Belgium, and there was a performer by the name of Romy, like R-O-M-Y, and you saw her competing against this guy, and there was sort of a deal made about how, like, this was you know, an unusual thing where it's not like just women and men competing against each other.
Right.
And so I thought she was a really interesting performer, but then the other guy was very technically adept, but very over-the-top hammy, and sort of showing in a demonstrative way his contempt for his competitor, so that when she was performing, he would do all these things to distract and draw attention to himself.
Yeah.
And he was so boorish, and I was annoyed to find out he won the competition, because I thought, well, he was really excellent in some ways, but in the end, his performance was too crappy and stupid.
Yeah.
And I thought she was the more interesting performer. But people thought that, you know, I guess they gave him the award because he was the alpha ape.
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes you just never know about these things. It can be so, you know, obviously, you know, if one watches today, if you watch American Idol or any of those other shows on TV or The Voice or The X Factor and so forth, you know, you sometimes don't know why these people are chosen. Occasionally, I pick the winner they pick, but there's sometimes I don't. You know, sometimes as I'm watching it, and I watch a few of these every now and then, they're interesting. Sometimes, you know, a good many times I have another winner that may not coincide. I may be hearing something else. I always had a little problem with competitions, and which is the reason why my seminars basically are not done in a competition sort of way, as you well know, Brian.
Oh yeah. Well, it's funny because it doesn't even seem to me like what satisfaction does it bring?
Yeah.
Because it's not as though you can compete in any way that is tangible. So it doesn't really lend itself to that. It almost implies that people aren't so interested in the experience of the music or the performance as much as they are of, like, an opportunity to have a contest in an arena that doesn't lend itself to it. So it always kind of seems like, well, why do you need that? Why do you want that? Like as though that were as desirable or more desirable than checking out the show. Or even if you talk with people about, like, oh, I like this, and I didn't think that was good, or that's very different than, like, being the prize winner and people focusing on winning prizes and awards.
Yeah, I think in the Mummers' case, you know, the whole competitive thing is, you know, I mean, these are a bunch of guys, basically, many of them working, you know, working guys, you know, working class guys. And I suppose at one level, just that goal, it can be a tremendous focus. For them, even though, yeah, obviously it's competitive.
In a way, that almost sort of feels more like it's, that's even a different kind of thing than in a world of, you know, conservatories or
institutional
competitions, like, because that's much more down-to-earth, neighborhood-y, you know, it's like
playing
kick the can or something.
Well, it's funny because, every year, I don't know if they still do it, but they used to do, after the Mummers Parade, they would do this big show in Convention Hall called the Show of Shows, where they would all do their thing indoors at a big concert. And, you know, it's an enormous space. And what they would do, they would assemble on the floor below, which ended, you know, can just imagine 22 string bands in this huge, huge space getting ready. As a matter of fact, I went along once with some of my buddies who were in Duffy, and I witnessed that. And I saw the culture firsthand of just all these bands in one huge area getting ready to go on. Then every band would perform before they went up on a lift. They would perform for the band. They would do their thing when it was their turn. And so what happened is they would do their whole marching routine. The only band who wouldn't do the marching routine would be Polish American. They would only perform without marching. And then they would, after they finished marching, they would go into a chorus, when they got finished playing, they would start, before they went up on the lift, they would break into the song, Our Band is Better Than Your Band. Our band's better than your band. They would sing that. And that was a routine. Everybody sort of expected it from them every year, and they got used to the idea of that. And it was the old Ralston Purina cartoon, you know, my dog's better than your dog, my dog's bigger than your dog. I don't know if you remember that. Or Kennel Ration, I think it was, and so forth. And they would deliver that before they went up.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm getting the itch right now to play something sort of in homage to the Mummers. And it's a little piece I wrote, and it's called Wail That Alto. And, you know, when the alto saxes play, they kind of do a wail. Lots of vibrato and almost a wailing sensation. So here is called Wail That Alto, dedicated to the Mummers. I have my accordion on. I'm just going to wire myself up right. And I think the microphone's on. Okay, here we go.
Thank you.
That was well that alto. Ah, could you hear it, Brian, from where you are?
I could hear it well, and I was wondering what kind of an accordion that was.
That's my Titanal Emperor.
Oh, it is?
Yeah, my big one.
Maybe over the phone, the sound is transformed.
Well, I'm sure it is.
It has a different character than I'm used to that having.
What kind of character were you getting?
Well, I thought you were playing some smaller, raunchier accordion.
Well, I was hoping it sounded that way, because that would be the mummer sound. The mummer sound was a raunchier sound.
Yeah.
So that could be the way I had the mic on. I wanted to create the effect of the mummer's band, you know, leaving from a distance, hearing them at a distance. Did you get that effect?
I kind of felt like because the accordion you played almost sounded like a steam calliope, it had a sound of like some distant vehicular thing that's approaching you slowly.
as long as it sounds like it was approaching slowly and leaving, that's the feeling one gets as you're watching the mummers appear and leave. And so I also wanted to, you know, give the effect of like a couple saxophones in harmony. And that wailing sound. Wow, wow, wow. Yeah, I wrote those charts out a long, long, long time ago to wail that alto. As a matter of fact, that goes back, I think I may have written that when I was 15 or 16. And
Wow.
We read it down in the Duffy Band. They had a little trouble with it. but we did a reading of it. I don't know if they ever took it on the parade. I don't know if it ever got out there. But obviously there's politics, and they have their own politics in their particular bands, and since I wasn't a member. But nonetheless, Wail of That Alto did get a mummer's reading in my life. So that's my little piece called Wail That Alto. And Brian, tell me what's going on with you right now.
Oh yeah, well, I learned a few interesting songs for a gig I did about a week ago.
Yeah.
That was on a boat, a little ferry boat. That departed from Hudson and went on a little two-hour trip.
Oh, nice.
Around the Hudson. And so there were various performers on the boat, and the idea was to concoct a performance that had the Hudson River in mind, or the region. So I learned a bunch of songs, like there was an interesting song by a local farmer called Acres of Apples that I learned. That was very funny. I learned the Troy University fight song, but I also learned a song that a friend of mine told me about that was recorded by Al Jolson in the 20s, but the song was written in 1918. It might have been part of some sort of a theatrical production, and it was called Why Did They All Take the Night Boat to Albany, Then Grab the Next Train for New York?
Yes, as a matter of fact, we're going to be hearing that. Is that right?
That's right.
Yeah. That's a great number, by the way.
Really taken with that song. And it's funny, too, because it contains a word that's sort of from the period, but maybe a kind of early use of it, the word flivver.
Yeah.
Which I thought was a synonym for jalopy, which it kind of is. But the song is from 1918, so in a way, it almost seems like early to have a concept of a jalopy, you know, before the automobile was really prevalent, and you wouldn't have the idea of somebody in their old junker Model T. So I think maybe in those days the word flivver just sort of meant like, oh, that's just a lot of baloney, or is not, you know, the bee's knees, or it doesn't matter. So it was interesting use of the slang term that sort of predates the thing it's known for now. But I got a real kick out of that song.
I like the fact that you were playing on this ferry boat. I think that's really, 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 really
too.
Yeah.
It got dark, so you couldn't really see out. It was great on the outside of the boat. You could see all the stars, but we were mostly indoors, and it was cold. But it was a beautiful night. So we're riding down the Hudson at night, and I got to do that song on the boat acoustically and try to make myself heard above the noise of the engine.
Well, that's wonderful. Yeah. I had a similar experience many, many years ago. It hasn't been recent. They had a riverboat cabaret in Manhattan. They may still have it for all I know, but occasionally I would play on this riverboat cabaret, and it would leave from downtown. It would go along the Hudson River. I don't remember whether it was by way of the East River or the Hudson River, but both, because it was, you know, the gig was a few hours long. And I would play on it with a group. We called ourselves the Mel Tormes, and we were basically a kind of a club date band. And we would play for, obviously, the people who would hire the boat. It could be a wedding, it could be any, could have been a party of some sort, but whoever booked this cabaret, we would play on that boat. And it was a couple decks. You know, you could go up on a higher deck and look around. And at nighttime, the city with all the lights all around was quite a gorgeous sight. I just remember how surreal everything looked on that boat at night, especially going down, seeing New York City from that boat.
Oh, yeah, great.
Yeah, I always enjoyed that. And so I did have a little experience playing, you know, playing aboard a boat. That was quite a long, long, long time ago. So it's nice to hear that you're doing that. You did that. When did you do it, Brian?
Last week.
Last week already. Yeah, yeah. And how long was the gig?
A couple of hours.
A couple hours.
I didn't play for 2 hours.
Yeah.
I played for a pretty brief amount of time.
Yeah. And did they have food and drink aboard the boat and everything?
They did.
Yeah.
They did indeed.
Yeah, so it was a good party and everything. Yeah.
Oh yeah, it was good, and the weather had been very dreary just before, and all of a sudden it cleared up and got to see the beautiful light behind the mountains and the stars coming out. There was even a bunch of shooting stars.
Shooting star, fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah, I saw one of them, and I heard other people say, "Oh, there's one! Oh, there's one!"
Yeah. Wow. Well, Brian, this was a wonderful chat. And I'm glad we're back on the air again, and all of you listening, get ready for some more wonderful radio shows here on WS Radio, the old In and Out. I'm going to sign off, Brian. We're going to be hearing Brian's piece, and it's called, again, what's the exact title again?
It's called Why Do They All Take the Night Boat to Albany?
Yes. And is there an author, or is it an unknown author?
The authors are known. I think there are three people who wrote them, but I can't think of their names now. But I could get back to you on that.
Well, that's okay. I just wanted to get what would be the ballpark time it was written?
Oh, it was written in 1918.
1918.
And
yeah.
I think, and Al Jolson recorded it in the late 20s.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Okay, we'll be hearing that from Brian, and you heard Whale That Alto from me. And so, good night, Brian.
Good night. It's a pleasure to
It's an absolute pleasure, too, Brian. And good night to all of you out there. This is William Schimmel, Dr. William Schimmel, Bill Schimmel, however you want it.
A river that touches New York. The rest of the river's just a flivver. Because it creates such a talk. Summertime, that's the time spooners used to go rambling about. Now they take trips on rickety ships, and here's what I want to find out. Why do they all take the night boat to Albany? That's what's puzzling me. They all claim it's just for the sights, but just the same, they travel at night. I asked a fellow and his cute little pet, how is the Hudson? And they answered, it's wet. So tell me, why do they all take the night boat to Albany and grab the next train to New York? Seems that each Tom and Dick and Harry is rid of his worries and cares. They found out the Hudson steamers carry a cargo of peaches and pears. Huddled and cuddled together with no one to shout, cut it out. No wonder they state the river is great. To me it's a river of doubt. Why do they all take the night boat to Albany? That's what's troubling me. They all claim it's just for the sights, but just the same, they travel at night. They play the searchlight on the shore as they float. Why don't they play the searchlight right on the boat? So tell me, why do they all take the night boat to Albany and grab the next train for New York?